ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Thursday, the 7th of March. I'm Stephanie Smale, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yugara people in Brisbane. Today, a super boost for mums and dads as the federal government promises to add contributions to paid parental leave. And pets on planes, Virgin Australia looking to open its cabin doors to furry friends in the next 12 months.
I'd love to sit next to a dog or a cat.
They're not just pet, but part of the family.
A cat would probably be less disruptive than like a little toddler or something.
Some people might be worried or afraid or allergic to them, especially with cats.
But first today, Victorian police have arrested a man over the disappearance of Ballarat woman Samantha Murphy. The mother of three left her Ballarat East home for a run on the morning of the 4th of February and hasn't been seen since. A 22-year-old man was arrested yesterday, but no charges have been laid. I spoke to our reporter Samantha Donovan about this development a short time ago.
Well, Steph, police are saying very little about the arrest at this stage. They've announced the 22-year-old man was arrested at his home at about 6 o'clock yesterday morning by missing persons squad detectives. He's been in custody since then, but no charges have been laid as yet. The police have made a point of saying they're not giving the street address of where the arrest was made, nor are they saying where the man is being held in custody. And they're stressing that while they know there's a lot of interest in this investigation, it's crucial that speculation about what may have happened to Samantha Murphy doesn't impede the investigation. Police are urging anyone who has any CCTV or dash cam footage that may be relevant to the investigation to come forward. And their statement this morning, Steph, asks that, quote, anyone who sights Samantha is asked to call 000 immediately.
And can you remind us how this case unfolded?
Yes, Samantha Murphy is from Ballarat, which is Victoria's third biggest city, northwest of Melbourne. She's a very keen runner, and at about 7 a.m. on Sunday, the 4th of February, she told her family she was heading out for a 14-kilometre run in bushland near her home. We understand she's very familiar with the trails in that area. But her family became very worried when she didn't return home. She was due at a brunch that day. So a big police search was launched. Ballarat is famous for being an old gold rush town, and there were initially fears Ms. Murphy may have fallen down an old mine shaft or had another type of accident. A few days after her disappearance, her husband Mick and eldest daughter Jess spoke to the media pleading for any information and asking people to come forward. Her daughter was understandably crying and very upset, sort of speaking directly to her mum and urging her to come home and saying she'd give her the biggest hug when she did. Jess Murphy said her mum was strong and determined and wouldn't give up. The family, Steph, is well known in the Ballarat area, and locals have turned out in huge numbers to help with the search. Police called off their formal search after a couple of weeks, but locals really kept scouring the bushland. About a week ago, police conceded, though, it was unlikely Samantha Murphy was still alive. We understand that police have used data or pings from a mobile phone to help them narrow their search to the Canadian Forest area on Ballarat's outskirts, but they've found no trace of Ms. Murphy or evidence, we understand, as to what may have happened to her. So, Steph, as I said, a 22-year-old Ballarat man now in custody, and we'll just watch out now for more news on the investigation from Victoria Police.
Samantha Donovan there. The new mums and dads relying on government-funded paid parental leave have been missing out on super while they've been away from work. But the federal government says that will change next year as part of their new gender equality strategy being launched today. Advocates say it's an important step, but they argue a raft of other measures are needed too. Alison Shaw reports.
It's a major change to the government's paid parental scheme and could help close Australia's retirement gap. On average, women retire with around 25% less super than men.
It won't eliminate that gap, but it will help to address it.
That's Treasurer Jim Chalmers.
We don't want to see women penalised in the superannuation system for the interrupted work patterns associated with having and looking after kids. Now, we want a more dignified and more secure retirement for more women.
The government has announced it will provide 12% super on paid parental leave from July next year. Reports suggest the move would cost more than $200 million a year. It's a key part of the government's new gender equality strategy, being announced today by Minister for Finance and Minister for Women, Katie Gallagher.
We think it's an investment that's worthwhile because it does two of those things, helps close that super gender pay gap, but also sends a very strong message that we don't think women should pay a financial penalty when they take time out of their paid work to care for children.
The move has been welcomed by advocates and the superannuation industry. Minister Gallagher says the government is also working to tackle other issues contributing to the gender pay gap.
We're trying to pull every lever we can, whether it be our industrial relations changes or it's, you know, supporting pay rises for the lowest paid caring industries.
Adding super to paid parental leave was most recently suggested by the Women's Economic Equality Task Force, asked by the government to recommend ways of improving the financial position of women.
You know, our recommendations went to the position and place of women right across our economy, whatever their circumstances are, not just as parents.
Businesswoman Sam Mostyn chaired the task force.
Today's decision by government would send a clear signal to employers everywhere that this is the best thing to do as well in the private sector. The superannuation on paid parental leave is another step in the direction to encourage more men to take leave. That is a big part of the adjustment we need to see in the Australian economy, is more men taking leave rather than it being assumed that it's simply women's work.
The task force made 7 recommendations to improve gender equality within the next decade.
Primary one is the provision of universal, high-quality, affordable childcare system. It's especially good for releasing women back into the workplace and the labour market. And if we could solve for that one and make the big, big investments, that would be the biggest single thing that could happen.
Sam Mostyn says the government's new gender equality strategy is a significant step in the right direction.
In Australia, we have some very, very long-held gender norms that the strategy will look at and say we've got to do really significant work to lift our sights and think more differently about the role of men and women, and don't see us continuing to accept that it's okay for women in their 50s to be the most likely cohort of Australians to be in poverty or moving into homelessness in their retirement.
Beverly Baker, president of the Older Women's Network, believes reforms need to be targeted towards women who are already dealing with inequality in retirement income, like raising the aged pension.
We're not looking at the women who are already there. And really, a strategy ought to look at the entire cohort. Really, the big impact is on the older aged women, women who don't have any super, who have never had access to super, women who actually stopped working to look after, care for their partners or their parents. And there's nothing to even recognise that older women are also workers, older women are also productive, and older women need some security as they age.
Today's National Gender Equality Strategy addresses work, health, leadership, and gender-based violence.
Alison Shaw reporting. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. After a longer than expected tussle, Donald Trump looks set for a second tilt at the White House. His last remaining opponent for the Republican nomination, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, has officially bowed out of the race. It follows Super Tuesday's clear results for Donald Trump and Joe Biden, but that doesn't mean it's going to be easy for either of them. Bruce Wolpe is a political analyst from the University of Sydney's United States Studies Centre, and we spoke a short time ago. Bruce Wolpe, thanks for joining us. The Super Tuesday results were very clear, and we're now looking at a Biden-Trump showdown in November. Have exit polls shone any light on who voters will pick as their political leader?
If you go behind the numbers, what happened yesterday was very interesting. Of 5.8 million votes that Joe Biden got, about 14% did not vote for him. Donald Trump had 6.7 million votes, but over 25% of Republicans voting yesterday voted for Nikki Haley or other candidates. So behind the numbers, there are different pressures against both candidates based on turnout and support within their parties.
So let's unpick that. What will be the big challenges going forward for President Biden?
The big challenge is to get those who haven't voted for him and those who are unenthusiastic about him, and that is a lot of Democrats. I mean, more than half the party is not happy that he's running. They like him, they like his policies, but they feel he's too old for a second term. And the question is, even faced with Trump, can Joe Biden get his coalition back, a prevailing winning coalition? For Donald Trump, he's masking this 25% of Republicans who are not voting for him. He hopes to attract Nikki Haley's voters back. But when she suspended her campaign earlier today, she did not endorse him. She did not give him a promise of support. And so how she signals her voters as to what to do in November, that could really affect Trump's margin at the election. And so we're left with an indecisive outcome on the most important day in both candidates in sealing the nomination of their parties.
You mentioned the former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley there, and she was Trump's last remaining opponent. Did her candidacy reveal weak points for Trump?
It did. She is the bridge between the Ronald Reagan Republican Party and the Trump Party. So on some culture value issues, she's with Trump. But in terms of America's leadership in the world, America being a beacon of democracy, America standing up to tyrants around the world, that's her imprint. And she carried that argument. But Trump absolutely beat her on those points because he wants to take America in an America first, bring the troops home, no foreign wars environment. So that is a real choice that Republican supporters will make. And I do think most of the party is sympathetic to where Nikki Haley is on those issues. But the base that Trump has really wants a change of leadership, direction, emphasis, support in the United States, and not to get embroiled overseas. But whether Haley Republicans can vote for Joe Biden, that's another bridge that might be too far.
So will Trump have to spend time and energy trying to win over Haley's supporters, or is that a done deal?
People have put to me, well, why doesn't he make her vice president, unite the party? That's not the kind of candidate or president he was. In 1980, Ronald Reagan took in George H.W. Bush as principal opponent. They were light years apart, came together, huge domination, absolutely smashed Jimmy Carter and governed for 12 years. Trump does not want to do that. So his emphasis is going to be, I want to reach every MAGA supporter, every Trump supporter, and get them amped up and get them to the polls. And that's where he's going to put his emphasis.
We've heard from voters across a range of states who say they're struggling financially and they want Donald Trump back in the Oval Office to fix that. Is he the man for that job, or are Biden's efforts being overlooked there?
We're going to get the test of that proposition, the State of the Union address, which will be Friday afternoon, Australia time. Biden wants to make the case for not only what has he achieved, but where he wants to take the country over the next 4 years. Where America should be in the world and the war in Ukraine and what he's trying to do to solve the war in Gaza. He will attack the Republicans sitting in front of him as being extremist, and that their extremist agenda, their Trump agenda, is not where America is. So this is his moment to show, yeah, I'm an old man, but I know where I want to take the country and I have the ability to do it. And I've done a good job so far. And I'm ready to continue as your president, and to have that be an uplifting moment that he can rebuild the coalition that is soft on him, principally because of the age and ability issue.
That's Bruce Wolpe from the United States Studies Center. To Gaza now, and since the war started on October 7, Israel has called up hundreds of thousands of reservists. It's compulsory to do military service and training in Israel. But some soldiers say after their time in the Israeli army, they no longer support the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Nicole Johnston spoke to one of them.
Nadav Weiman was a sniper in the Israeli Special Forces for 3 years from 2005.
In the West Bank, it feels like a video game. You plan something, you win, and that's it. And then we were sent to the Gaza Strip, and it's a whole different ballgame.
He's now the deputy director of Breaking the Silence, an organisation that collects testimonies from Israeli soldiers about their time in the army. The group also opposes Israel's military occupation. Mr. Vyman says he's still coming to terms with his time in the military.
The minute you cross the fence, they started to fire mortars at us. And when we approached for the first line of houses, you know, the commands are different. In Gaza, before you reach the houses, so you open fire with machine guns and artillery and tanks, so they would know we are coming. When we broke into the house, you don't knock the door down. You knock one of the walls of the house with a tank or with an APC, because they told us all of the houses are booby trapped, and then you storm the house. And it's not like in the West Bank that you grab all of the family members, you put them in one room, and somebody would sit with his gun on them so they won't move. You take all of the men from like 16 years old to 60, and you put them on a truck, and the truck takes them back to Israel for interrogation. So the language is war. The command you get is war. And for me, it was one of the most outrageous things that I did.
Nadav Vyman says soldiers follow an Israeli military strategy known as the Dahir Doctrine. It's believed to have originated during the 2006 Lebanese War. Mr. Vyman says it explains the scale and intensity of the battle in Gaza.
Dahir Doctrine means that you need to inflict unproportional damage to civilian infrastructure. Tunnels, roads, bridges, water facilities, universities, all of that. So Hezbollah in the north and Hamas in the south would have to deal with rebuilding South Lebanon or the Gaza Strip. We will fight forever. So that's the doctrine.
The Israeli government insists any destruction of Gaza's infrastructure is necessary to destroy Hamas, and it denies using disproportionate force. Nadav Vyman believes Israel's military occupation will never bring peace.
When you grow up in Israel and you believe that after you finish high school, go to the army to protect Israel, suddenly you meet the people that are supposed to be the enemy. And when you meet them, they're human beings just like me and you. And when you start to understand that you're not really fighting terror all of the time or protecting Israel, but enforcing military law on civilians that don't want our control, yeah, for me it was like a slap in the face. What surprised me the most is because of the Israeli media, I've got to say, that doesn't really show what's happening in Gaza and censor everything for us. People in Israel don't really understand what we're doing over there. The world sees Gaza and Israelis see Gaza in a very different way. And we are here. And I feel all of these things are contributing to the fact that soldiers are doing a lot more bad things than usual inside Gaza. You know, there's lots of videos on social media, on TikTok and on Instagram of soldiers looting or burning Palestinian homes in the Gaza Strip.
Some of these videos have been analysed by the media, including the New York Times. They appear to show the destruction of civilian property. The Israeli military says it is fighting a complex war. Nadav Vyman says Israeli soldiers who've been inside Gaza in this war are now giving testimonies to his group.
Nicole Johnston reporting, and the ABC has contacted the Israel Defence Forces for comment. The share market operator, the ASX, has been hit with a $1 million fine for breaching its own transparency and integrity rules more than 8,000 times. The ASX is blaming a systems error, but corporate regulator ASIC says that's not good enough and has vowed to hold the market operator to the highest standards. For more, I spoke with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, how significant is this fine and how badly does it dent the ASX's reputation?
Well, Stephanie, this is the first time ASIC has slapped the ASX with any sort of penalty, just over $1 million for 8,400 breaches between April 2019 and December 2022. ASIC found serious misconduct where the ASX failed to make information available about orders on its trading system, on prices and liquidity opportunities so investors could properly assess investment opportunities in listed companies. Well, why does this matter? Well, we all rely on an open market, trust and integrity so investors are fully informed. ASIC Chair Joe Longo told me while no individual was hurt, the reputation of the market was, and investors need to be able to trust the openness and efficiency of the share market.
Incidents like this hurt the market because the market integrity rules are there, as the name suggests, to promote a market that has integrity, that people can trust, so that when they place an order, they know how that order is going to be handled, so there can be efficiency, fairness and transparency. So although you can't point to a particular person getting hurt, complying with rules like this, then that leads to the kind of market we're all prepared to trade in.
This is the first time the ASX has been hit with such a fine or any fine. So is this a shot across the bows that they really do need to lift their act?
All of these things taken together point in one direction, and that is we need to continue to raise standards at ASX in order to maintain confidence in it. Now, they've made progress, but we can't be complacent.
ASIC Chair Joe Longo with the ABC's Peter Ryan. And Peter, how has the ASX responded to the $1 million penalty?
Well, Stephanie, the ASX self-reported these breaches and they've been fully cooperating with ASIC, but they put the strife down to a systems configuration error that impacted certain orders. Now, to put these 8,000 plus orders in context, the ASX is saying around 76 million orders are received and processed every day. But this is the latest woe for the ASX, which remains embroiled in multiple regulatory investigations and actions over its failure to replace its clearing and settlement technology known as CHESS. So getting a lot of heat from ASIC and the Reserve Bank, issues that have gone to the ASX's credibility and reputation.
ABC Senior Business Correspondent Peter Ryan there. Australian air travellers could soon be sharing the cabin with four-legged friends if Virgin Australia's plan to bring pets on board is approved. But not everyone is barking with excitement, and some allergy advocacy groups are warning it could be a safety issue. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
We take our pets to the cafe, the beach, to Bunnings, and soon it'll be easier to take them on holidays too.
Virgin Australia is going to make it possible for small dogs and cats to travel on board the aircraft. This is a first in Australia. We're super excited to be launching this. It is a commonplace thing overseas.
The move is subject to the approval of regulators, which Virgin hopes to get within 12 months. But not all dogs and cats will have the opportunity.
There are designated rows that these dogs can travel in, dogs and cats. They'll be in a designated carrier, so it will have to fit certain size specifications, and that carrier must sit underneath the seat in front of the passenger.
The animals will have to be in their carrier from the moment they arrive in the airport until they reach their destination airport. There will be a cost, but those details won't be decided until there's final approval. And while some Aussies are thrilled...
I'd love to sit next to a dog or a cat. I feel like that's something fun to experience.
I love cats and dogs, so I'd probably enjoy it, to be honest.
Not everyone is keen on the idea.
My concern is that not all dog owners train their dogs well. And as somebody said to me the other day, there are no bad dogs, there are just bad owners.
I wouldn't, primarily because I don't have a pet myself. So if I don't have one at home, why would I want to sit next to one on a plane?
The program will only include cats and dogs, so it's bad luck for birds, guinea pigs and snakes. It doesn't change Virgin's policy on approved assistance animals, which can travel in the cabin at no extra cost. Maria Sade is the CEO of Allergy and Anaphylaxis Australia.
Certainly from an allergy perspective, it is an issue for some people, and triggering an asthma attack when someone's up in the sky in an enclosed space in amongst all the animal dander is not a good thing.
And she argues having designated rows aren't enough to make sure all customers are safe.
Animal dander gets in the air, so even if they're down one end of the plane, you can't say that a person sitting down the other end of the plane isn't going to have an allergic reaction.
Professor Greg Bamber is an aviation expert from Monash University. He says there are a few challenges to consider. In the United States, some pet-carrying customers have reported not being allowed on flights at the last minute.
Because the rules vary from
one airline to another in North America, and they say that the pet must be able to stand up in the container and turn around without their head or any part of their body touching the sides of the cage. So sometimes the staff have discretion about how the rules should be interpreted.
And he says some might even be nervous flyers.
If there's a bumpy landing, for example, or if there's bumps in the flight, and that can induce them to wee or poo or fart, and that might be annoying other passengers who are in close proximity.
Aviation expert Professor Greg Bamber ending that report by Elizabeth Cramsey and Rachel Hayter. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Stephanie Smale.